Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of my Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on August 11, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Paramadivaharan Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches the importance of developing and dwelling in refined mindfulness. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
So today's talk is on the Paramadivaharan Sutta, a sutta on establishing and maintaining mindfulness through the practice of restraint. I'm not going to read the introduction, but I'll talk a little bit about it. There's a phrase, a common phrase that goes something like, life is a banquet, don't leave the table hungry, which is really speaks to the consumerism of our society, isn't it? That we're always supposed to take as much as we can get. And that's likely an adaptation from a saying that is attributed to Aristotle, who was, I think he was, he lived about 150 years after the Buddha's passing. And he said something like, rise from life as from a banquet, neither thirsty nor drunken, meaning practice the middle way is really what he was talking about. And it is at refined mindfulness developed through the Eightfold Path, resting in Shamatha Vipassana meditation, is a practice that leads to mindful restraint. It doesn't mean that we should not engage in life at all, which is an extreme view, but it does mean we shouldn't overindulge. And the underlying cause of that overindulgence is an insatiable ego personality, isn't it? That's never satisfied. And so that gets directly to the heart of the Buddhist teachings of understanding and abandoning all views rooted in ignorance that give rise to a self-referential ego personality that can never be satisfied. Let me read the sutta and I'll comment as we go along. This is really one of the things Lauren and I were talking a little earlier. I think it is at this point, whether people really understand it or not, that they become turned off from what the Buddha's teaching, because any type of restraint to an ego personality is something that an ego doesn't want to deal with, or anatta is another word that we could use within the Buddha's teachings. We're so ingrained with constantly feeding this self-referential ego self that anything that would propose an idea like practicing even a small amount of restraint at the senses, at the five physical senses and thinking, the sixth sense, is just something that most people can't handle. And it's at this point that they give up or they find something else that allows them to satisfy their ego personality, meaning constantly grasping, whether it's within a so-called religious / spiritual practice that allows for constant grasping and fulfillment of that, meaning going after, chasing after concepts and creating identities over those concepts. Rather than getting to the heart of the matter, which is where wrong views drive us towards. So let me read the sutta. The Buddha is talking. Friends, pay close attention. I will teach you about one who dwells in mindlessness and one who dwells in mindfulness. Of course, this is the essence of the Buddha's teachings, isn't it? And how does one dwell in mindlessness? When one is unrestrained at the eye, the mind is agitated and distracted by mental fabrications. When agitated and distracted, there is no joyful engagement with the Dhamma. Lacking joyful engagement with the Dhamma, there is no serenity. There is only disappointment and distraction. Excuse me. When the mind is distracted, there can be no Dhamma. What a statement, isn't it? When the mind is distracted, there's no Dhamma in that mind. The Dhamma is only present. And I'm not talking now of a doctrinal look at the Dhamma. The experience of living within the Dhamma cannot be had by a mind distracted. This is why a right meditation method is so important within the Eightfold Path. Nothing else will work unless it's a meditation practice that is geared toward deepening concentration and not something else. lacking the Dhamma, there is only dwelling in mindlessness. So think of the ramifications of this. You can be doing things, thinking that they're so-called spiritual or even just wholesome, but if all that they are practices that encourage more distraction, you won't even notice that you're engaged in a mindless life. And this is what the Buddha is talking about here. This is the importance of restraint. The Buddha continues, when one dwells unrestrained over the ear or the nose or the tongue or the body, the mind is agitated and distracted. There is no joyful engagement with the Dhamma. Lacking joyful engagement with the Dhamma, there is no serenity. There is only disappointment and distraction. The Buddha's first teaching, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the first teaching on the Four Noble Truths, starts with that definition. Dukkha occurs. Dukkha is stress, it's disappointment, it's unsatisfactory experiences arising from wrong views, from a wrong understanding of the way life is in the world. And so we create these very powerful and elaborate strategies to continue to ignore our own ignorance. Another word for those strategies is mindlessness. And so we engage in an endless series of mindless activities, some that may seem very, very wholesome and useful to us, when in fact, they're simply more distraction. They don't ultimately lead to a calm and peaceful mind, to a mind of equanimity. Lacking the Dhamma, there is only dwelling in mindlessness. When one dwells unrestrained of thoughts, the mind is agitated and distracted by ideological fabrications. This is really getting to the heart of the matter, because it is our enchantment and our being enamored with our own thoughts, because our thoughts are what we're using to establish ourselves in this impermanent world, that becomes the ultimate challenge of letting go of those thoughts. Initially recognizing that these thoughts that I have, that I'm using to describe myself in relation to my environment, are rooted in ignorance. But if we can understand that one point, this is the essence of the Buddhist teaching, if we can understand that one point and truly get it, we'll eagerly let go of those views, won't we? Because we understand that the views are arising in ignorance. And what are they ignorant of? They're ignorant of Four Noble Truths. The Buddha didn't teach that as human beings we're simply ignorant, we're just a step above cows. I don't know why I use that phrase. I like cows. He said it's a very specific ignorance. It's ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Of course, Four Noble Truths describe human reality. And that's all that it describes. It's not, the Buddha's not interested in describing anything else except how to live successfully in this lifetime, in this world. And how can we do that if our minds are still rooted in ignorance of the way things truly are? Now, of course, that doesn't mean that we haven't acquired knowledge of certain things. We're all relatively successful in our lives. So we've learned skills to do that. But as far as understanding the way human life really operates, unless we've developed the Eightfold Path or have some other way of developing insight, we can't understand it, can we? And that leads to ultimate frustration. It leads to ongoing mindlessness. How could a mind be mindful of what's occurring if it doesn't know of what's occurring? Is that clear? So we're getting to some very refined points in the Dhamma that the Buddha's talking about here. Let me go back one sentence there. When one dwells unrestrained of thoughts, the mind is agitated and distracted by ideological fabrications. There is no joyful engagement with the Dhamma. Lacking joyful engagement with the Dhamma, there is no serenity. There is only disappointment and distraction. When the mind is distracted, there can be no Dhamma. Lacking the Dhamma, there is only dwelling in mindlessness. The Buddha keeps reiterating that point. We create concepts in our minds that fulfill wrong views of self and make that self feel comfortable in this world. We do it in spiritual and religious practices, but we also do it in ordinary mundane practices. And once we create an identity based on that, what the Buddha's teaching here, what I'm hoping to teach here, is it's very, very difficult. It takes concerted right effort to first recognize those wrong views and then to abandon them. because it's those views that we're using to describe ourselves to ourselves. It's who we are. And so this is something that is similar to this thought comes up often, especially with people that are first getting a grasp of what the Buddha is teaching. And it's this underlying fear that what happens when I let go of all views of self? It feels like annihilation. It feels like there's going to be nothing left. And it feels like that because we've developed our entire worldview based on these wrong views. So think about that. If everything I know is based on these views, how can I possibly let go of the views? There'll be nothing left of me, will there? And there won't. There'll be nothing left of a self rooted in wrong views. A self that literally does not exist except in our own minds. That's what the Buddha awakened to. That we're all living, and he used these words, we're all living a life that is like an illusion. Notice he didn't use the words that we're living an illusion, which is what many people will say. In fact, a lot of the Yogacara Buddhist schools is based on that notion, that everything is an illusion. Everything is not an illusion. We perceive reality like it's an illusion. And we're the magician. We're playing a trick on ourselves because our views are rooted in ignorance of the way things truly are. Did I make that point clear?
Could you just say that again?
I hope so. We have developed a view of the world rooted in wrong views, rooted in ignorance. And so since we're seeing the world, we're seeing our world, literally our life, from a wrong view, from a view that doesn't reflect reality, we're living our life like an illusion. The reason why that's important, that like an illusion part, not an illusion, is that there is a reality here. This is, again, going, not to beat up the Yogacara school, not that I think there's any value there, but it gets to the heart of the matter that there, the difference between what the Buddha taught as anatta and what the common misunderstanding of anatta is that there's no such thing as a self. The Buddha never taught that. He taught that the views that we have are rooted in wrong views. They don't accurately describe a self. They're not a self. But underlying those views is reality. And that reality is occurring simultaneously while we're experiencing life from wrong views. Just like a magician's trick. He's got us looking over here. We have ourselves looking over here when life is occurring here. We're missing the whole point. We're missing an understanding of reality. And once we gain that understanding of reality, Laura and I talked briefly about this morning, once we get an understanding of reality, of the impermanent nature of all things, and that I've been living my life from a wrong view of the impermanent nature of all things, notice I'm mentioning the first two marks of existence, then I will no longer contribute to my own suffering, the third mark of existence. Everything the Buddha taught, all of the insight that he taught to gain, is focused on gaining insight to the three marks of existence. Not to compassion, not to selflessness, not to honesty, not to love, not to anything else. Those are all wonderful things that we develop as a consequence of an awakened mind. To gain insight into the three marks of existence, to the impermanent nature of all things, to the understanding that up until a certain point, when I develop the Eightfold Path, my views are rooted in ignorance, they're wrong views, and because of that, I create suffering in the world. I create my own disappointment. That's the first noble truth. The Buddha awakened, excuse me, probably the most important teaching the Buddha ever gave is one of the most misunderstood and misapplied teachings, and that's dependent origination. Primarily taught in the Paticca-Samuppada Sutta, but in many other suttas. In fact, I mentioned it earlier in the introduction to this. What the Buddha awakened to was that it is ignorance of four noble truths that leads to all manner of suffering. And he described that as occurring through 12 observable causative links. Those are called the 12 links of dependent origination. I won't get into that teaching. They're up on the board, and I teach it often. But what that describes is that rooted in that initial ignorance, we create all the confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering in our own lives. It's not something that's happening to us. It's not something that occurs to us because there's something wrong with us or there's something lacking in us. accept understanding, we're not being punished in any way. Again, these are all concepts that come from a religious point of view. It's simply that we're lacking an understanding of the way things truly are. We're lacking mindfulness. That's what this teaching is all about. The last line again. This is how one dwells in mindlessness. Now we get to the good part. And how does one dwell in mindfulness? When a Dhamma practitioner dwells in restraint with the eye, with the nose, with the ear, with the tongue, and with the body, the mind is not agitated or distracted by mental fabrications. This is the point where the rubber meets the road. This is the point where the Dhamma meets reality at our senses. Now think about that. How else could it be? Another key component of what the Buddha is teaching, or maybe I should use a key understanding, and this is something that is hardly ever addressed, is the Buddha's teaching is designed to unite the mind and the body. And rather than using concepts to take the mind out of the body, whether throwing the mind to the past or to the future, meaning in a acquisitory, that's not even a word, through thinking that if I acquire something, then I'll be awakened, meaning I do rituals or I act in a certain way and I'll be gifted a reward. A mind united in the body is a mind that is present for life as life occurs. It's a mind that is not distracted. That's the essence of what the Buddha is teaching. In order to do that, we have to let go of all wrong views, all conceptual views, and recognize and be present simply with ourselves as our life is unfolding. And that's the great reward. That's the great power of the Eightfold Path. It allows us to finally be present in our life without the need for our life to be any different than it is. It's the essence of mindfulness. I simply understand what's occurring. And since I'm no longer taking anything personal, I've abandoned self-referential views. I'm no longer taking anything personal. Everything is just as it is. It's not good, it's not bad. But my mind is at peace. And it's at peace because I understand the impermanence of all things. So when something happens to me that my mind judges less than ideal, I don't have to react to it because I know it's impermanent and I know it's not happening to me. It's simply happening as a consequence of having a human life. When the Buddha described the nature of dukkha, he described it this way: birth is suffering. What he's saying is that the act of being born is not suffering. Having a human life is suffering. Now remember the context. It's because of ignorance of Four Noble Truths that birth leads to suffering. Then he says that sickness is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering. Not getting what is desired is suffering, getting what is undesired is suffering. And then he would always conclude that statement by saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. The five clinging aggregates are form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing consciousness. That's consciousness rooted in wrong views. It's not some grand cosmic consciousness. The five clinging aggregates simply describe the ongoing personal experience of suffering. And when you look at those five aggregates, one is part of the body, isn't it? Form. The other four are all mental qualities. So again, the Buddha is teaching us that we need to clear up our thinking, go from wrong view to right view, and unite those mental qualities within the form that we have. Life is to be experienced as a mind united in the body. That is mindfulness. And there is no mindfulness when the mind is distracted. It's a simple definition of mindfulness, wouldn't it be? How could a mind be mindful if it's distracted? So the ultimate essence of the Buddha's teaching is this refined mindfulness that is framed by the Eightfold Path, and only by the Eightfold Path. And it only rests in concentration that's developed through Shamatha Vipassana meditation. That's the only meditation method the Buddha ever taught for 45 years. And he was incredibly consistent with that. The Buddha developed his awakening in a time very, very similar to ours as far as spiritual practices. And he studied all of the well-known and well-established and well-attended spiritual practices of his time. He studied the meditation methods of his time, the most advanced meditation methods of his time. And he rejected all of them because it didn't lead to his goal of uniting the mind and the body, of developing refined mindfulness. And that's when he developed and taught Samatha Vipassana meditation. And you remember, well, you might remember that in the Nagara Sutta, where the Buddha describes his awakening and being caught up in a feedback loop of wrong views, stuck in that consciousness that is rooted in continued ignorance. And how do you escape that? He taught that he realized an eightfold path that he used to extricate himself from his own wrong views. And then he spent the next 45 years of his life teaching only that. If you want to develop this refined mindfulness, here's the path. It's a very simple and direct path.
Let me continue. John, can I add something?
Sure.
Now I was like trying to hold on to that thought and I knew it would leave, but when I was just asking you to like rephrase the thing about like an illusion and illusion, what I was hearing and contemplating, because I think the sutta is very straightforward, again, like all of them, that when from the rooted, you know, when you're moving from rooted ignorance and there is no restraint, there's only agitation, dissatisfaction, stress, you know, that's just what it is, period. And when there is some inkling of wisdom, which I think we can all kind of see the slider moving up and down the scale, like the cessation part, where there's, the mind does have serenity, there is joy, because then we're moving from the life like an illusion into reality as it is. Like you can feel the letting go of the grasping and the clinging for moments. So I think that's, you know, again, kind of very clear in here that it's like an illusion because it's rooted in ignorance and there's a felt sense of a self clinging and craving. Or you're resting in serenity and joy and sukha, whatever, you know, some sense of ease in there. So I don't know. I mean, that's anyway. I was just thinking of that.
No, it's a good point. Thank you. And what the Buddha's teaching here, and we have to remember, and it's important to understand how the Buddha came to these conclusions and these understandings, and I just talked about that. He practiced all different methods. What he's talking about here is not to get stuck in what Mora is talking about. It's such an important point. We can engage in a lot of practices that'll start making us feel better. It used to drive Mora crazy when I used this metaphor. So excuse me for using it again. Going bowling on Thursday nights makes a lot of people feel better. And so they become compulsive about that, because it relieves their agitation for a few moments. And we can do that with so-called spiritual practices. A good example for me, the first meditation method I ever learned was transcendental meditation. And it immediately brought me a measure of peace in my mind, at least while I was meditating, and even after I stopped the method. And I did this as taught for 2 years. But after about 2 years, it got to the point where I realized this isn't taking me any further. And it's only giving me a measure of peace, mostly on my cushion and a little bit of concentration off my cushion. But there was nothing there, and I didn't even realize it, there was nothing there to give me understanding of who I was in relation to the world. There wasn't anything complete about that. It was, and most of the teaching surrounding transcendental meditation had to do with ritual and doing enough meditation to get favor from some amorphous spiritual system. It just didn't make much sense to me. And I'm greatly simplifying TM. And then I tried all kinds of other meditation methods that initially made me feel good. Anytime you sit down and find something that can help you relax yourself, it's going to make you feel better. But lacking the context of it's not just meditation. It's not just about finding a way to momentarily develop a peaceful mind, but a complete practice of recognizing that in thought, word, and deed, I must be well focused, I must be developing mindfulness. There's no way to get out of that ignorance. Just feeling good isn't it. And that's what more was, I think that was what you were, the point you were making.
The basic, you know, restraint at the sense gates or understanding that that will only lead to further dissatisfaction and agitation.
Yes, it has to be continued.
Well, who wants to live that way? So you mentioned, and I was like, I wasn't going to say this, but the word religion. And I think of religiosity as like, okay, you can think of a formalized religion or the desire to live a life that's free and meaningful. So true mindfulness in some way, and this could be argued, has a religiosity because it's concerned with what matters most in life. Like, do I want to live clinging, craving, agitated, or do I want to be free?
Yeah, I don't... yeah, of course you could say that there's some religiosity about mindfulness, and the important thing about this is that the Buddha's teaching a very refined mindfulness. The mindfulness that's around today has too broad of an application.
Right, but I'm saying that it's a question of ultimate concern, which is so like ultimate concern meaning what is my relationship to this world?
I'm not sure if I'm following you there.
So I mean,
as an ultimate concern, But mindfulness is a refined mindfulness. The Buddha's teaching is a quality of mind that's rooted in understanding.
Right, ultimate concern.
I don't know that I would put it that way. I don't think having an ultimate concern relates.
All right,
very well to this.
I'm going to drop that.
Oh, okay. But you got me thinking about it. I guess if you put it that the ultimate concern is awakening, developing full human maturity, but I think the word concern to a mind that is still confused leads to something that is so prevalent in modern Buddhism, meaning engaged Buddhism. And so then there's a substitution. I know you're not saying that, but then there's a substitution that if I'm just compassionate about everything, then I'm practicing the Dhamma. And that's actually an extremely wrong view because it allows for continued ignorance. And it's really what leads many, many people astray. And that is a religious view, isn't it?
That's a
salvation view.
I'm just really meaning that each one of us comes in with some existential question.
Okay. The Buddha continues. There is joyful engagement. I better go back now because... And how does one dwell in mindfulness? When a Dhamma practitioner dwells in restraint with the eye, with the nose, with the ear, with the tongue, and with the body, the mind is not agitated or distracted by mental fabrications. You know, that's the second, or the beginning of dependent origination. From ignorance as a requisite condition come mental fabrications. That's the beginning. Mental fabrications are holding in mind wrong views and conceptual wrong views, rooted in ignorance. There is joyful engagement with the Dhamma. There being joyful engagement with the Dhamma, there is serenity, there is contentment. The Dhamma is present moment by moment, and they dwell in mindfulness. When one dwells well restrained of thoughts, the mind is not agitated or distracted. When one dwells well restrained of thoughts, that's something that none of us want, at least initially. We don't want to think that we should restrain our thoughts or even think about restraining our thoughts, right? Our thoughts are our thoughts. I can do whatever I want with them. And we can. But if we want to develop awakening as the Buddha teaches awakening, we'll understand that we can gain control of our thoughts. The Bhadakarata Sutta, the Buddha teaches that we can think what we want to think when we want to think it. Isn't that wonderful? Think about that. To always have a mind that is thinking what it wants to think, what's appropriate to what's occurring, rather than reacting to what's occurring. The only way that's possible is to understand what's occurring, to understand the three marks of existence, to have a mind that is well concentrated and resting in the refined mindfulness that is ultimately described as right view, a complete understanding of what's occurring. When one dwells well restrained of thoughts, the mind is not agitated or distracted by ideological fabrications. Think about all the trouble in the world today, particularly in our country, but really in the world. Most of it's arising from insisting that whatever ideological view you have is the only right view. And there's some extreme sides being taken on ideology that have no real basis in reality. I'm not just talking about one political side or another. This is prevalent in our country and it's prevalent in the world. And it seems like we've gotten, in general, more entrenched in ideology rather than listening to each other and letting people have their own ideological views without hatred or all the other things that follow from that. How can we get there? When we gain an understanding of where ideology comes from, rooted in wrong views ultimately, then at least as individuals, we won't feel like taking up the opposite cause. We won't feel like engaging in constant conflict with others. We'll be at peace because we understand the nature. We have gained an understanding of the nature of conflict within ourselves, and so now we understand the nature of conflict in the world. It has nothing to do with ideology or any particular ideology prevailing. In fact, that would just make things worse. More?
I think I don't have a problem with ideology, but I think when it infringes on my ability to live my life as I feel would be the right way to live, that's where it gets a little dicey.
Okay.
Yeah, I can be totally at peace with people having completely different views than me, but when the rights are changed, that gets up, that's all. I was just thinking that when you were talking, like, yeah, ideology, you can say whatever you want, but say, I'm just throwing it out there, if I want to have an abortion, and
I don't mean like to argue with you, but it sounds like you're placing a condition on your peace of mind.
That is true.
And that's described by Duke occurs. Where the transition that we're in this country is not something that you can attribute to any one human being, no matter how much you'd like to. The question has arisen. The Buddha describes what's occurring right now accurately 2,600 years ago. Dukkha occurs. Mm-hmm. And what's occurring right now is dukkha. It's a consequence of having a human life. Wanting that thing to be different than it is what creates agitation in my mind and creates conflict in the world. That doesn't mean that we should all just lay down and let whatever occurs, but if we can see what's occurring in reality without reacting to it, then we can make some real change. If we're reacting to it in any way, taking offense to it, then we're lacking understanding, aren't we? There being joyful engagement with the Dhamma, there is serenity. That defines just what we're talking about, isn't it? If I'm joyfully engaged in the Dhamma, it doesn't mean that I become an idiot. I'm not aware of what's occurring around me. In fact, it means just the opposite. I'll understand what's occurring at a very, very profound level, and I will no longer react to it. I'll be at peace with it. I won't have to take up a cause to continue to establish my views. I'll simply understand what's occurring. Again, we forget that the Buddha lived in very, very turbulent times. There were constant battles right going around him all the time. There were great ideological views that were always coming at loggerheads during the Buddha's time. And yet this human being was able to disentangle himself from the world because of his understanding and live at peace. And because he was able to live at peace, he was able to counsel people towards peace. Even many years after his passing, one of the most violent human beings that ever lived in our human existence, in our human history, was King Ashoka. That phrase that putting a head on pikes came from King Ashoka. When he would conquer another village or another area of India, he would cut people's heads off and put them on pikes to prove how violent he was and how scared you should be of him. And he did this all over northern India, and he started, and most of I'm trying to say that he ruled northern India and he started taking over southern India in the same way. He was incredibly powerful. He came across the Buddha's true teachings, his authentic teachings. He understood it at such a profound level that he let go of all of his ideology and he lived a life of incredible peace. And it's mostly because of King Ashoka and the rock edicts that he wrote. Rock edicts are all over northern India. You can still find some of them. He wrote the Dhamma down on these stone tablets, much like the Ten Commandments. And some of those are still available today. He so changed from going from that ideological view that he had to a mind resting in peace that 2,300 years ago he started universal health care, something we still can't figure out today. Really. If you got sick under King Ashoka's reign, you were taken care of immediately. He went so much further than that. He started universal veterinary care. This is true compassion, but had no ideology at all. And by the way, King Ashoka also said, it's okay if you look at other religions. This is what I learned. No ideology there at all. To me, that's just a remarkable story. There being joyful engagement with the Dhamma, there is serenity. There is contentment. The Dhamma is present moment by moment, and they dwell in mindfulness. This is how one dwells in mindfulness. That's today's talk, today's sutta. Pretty remarkable, isn't it? And the sutta covers so much. What Morik was bringing up, it has so many implications. But the teaching is very simple and direct, isn't it? If you want to gain control of your mind, integrate the Eightfold Path. If you want to gain control of your mind, if you want to develop true mindfulness, let go of all the concepts and all the little games and things that we play, and the mindfulness games, and develop the Eightfold Path. Then we know what we're developing. It doesn't become something conceptual. It doesn't become something that we're using to continue life like an illusion, that we're doing something that feels good or might sound good or might be accepted by a lot of people. We develop an Eightfold Path. The same path that the Buddha taught, the same path that he used to awaken, the same path that King Ashoka awakened from, is the same path that's present today. And that's how we develop refined mindfulness. So again, excuse two talks today. Any questions about the talk? We'll go around the room. Lorna, good to see you this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for your talk. You covered a lot of ground today.
Excuse me.
John, could you shut the air off, please?
Sure.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I came with the view of impermanence, and I've been thinking about that a little more than usual, and I've always thought of impermanence as being impermanence of putting things behind you in life and putting situations in life behind you and things. But I think I'm beginning to realize that impermanence is more about the impermanence of what we think about as ourselves.
Yeah.
And that's the meaning of impermanence, that it's not about thoughts that we've had throughout our lives, it's how we think about ourselves, that to carry on moment by moment hanging on to ourselves is not a good way to think, that impermanence is more about going to the next moment without ourselves, without anatta. And it's anatta that impermanence is all about, really. And it's not about a thought or a place or a tree or a thing. It's about getting to the next moment without ourselves. Sometimes when you come to your class, John. You just teach the right thing at the right time. And today has just been a bit of a conflict with me. I've got this impermanence thing sort of buzzing around in my head. And I know today, in a manner, today's teaching is not about that. So I've had a bit of sort of conflict in my head about listening to you. But just to say that all that you've talked about today, it just makes so much sense to me. Just so much sense. That's all I can say. It's just my way of thinking. All they've talked about today, I completely agree with. And there's not many times you can sit for, what have we been sitting here for 45 minutes or something, and you listen to somebody talk for 45 minutes and completely agree with them. It never happens in life. You know, your mind, or you kind of get some conflict going. But all that you've said today, I completely agree with. That's all I can say today.
Thank you. Does everybody completely agree with me?
I completely agree with everything that Buddha teaches and what you teach.
What a wonderful way to put understanding, that we don't carry anatta into the next moment. We can't carry wrong views unless we put a concerted effort to maintaining those views. That's stress. That really is the underlying dukkha, is the stress induced by maintaining views that simply don't fit reality, yet we all do it. And it really is great insight. And when we look at life that way, then every moment is a new, this is the true meaning of the Buddha's teachings on birth and rebirth. Every moment is new because we're not seeing it from a conceptual point of view. We're seeing it simply by what's occurring. And how do we do it? Through an Eightfold Path, through developing right view and proper mindfulness. Thank you. And I would say, and I would bet on reflection, the entire teaching is a teaching on impermanence.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, everything is.
You know, everything the Buddha teaches is to the three marks.
And impermanence.
Yes.
It's just seeing what it is.
Yep.
Yeah.
Thank you. Anthony, good to see you.
Good morning. There's so many concepts interrelated in this talk. Yeah, it just covers everything: clinging, craving, Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. I liked when you said that it's when you're mindful, nothing can bother you.
Yeah.
You know, and I started thinking about that. And one of the things that Lorna alluded to was wanting to be somewhere. Like, I always think when a lot of stress occurs, when you're projecting ahead and you want to be somewhere you're not.
Yeah.
And also, I find with myself that a lot of times, if I'm having an angry thought or a sad thought, I'll want to change the channel or replace it with a happy thought, which might not be a bad thing to do once in a while, but I think mindfulness really means to sit with what you're experiencing.
Yeah.
And if it's sad, just be sad. Don't push it away. Because a lot of times, you know, and when you do that, if you're angry at something or practicing metta or just experiencing the anger, we'll let it dissolve a lot quicker.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that's what I'm trying to work with. And I find that it works. Like, we'll learn this technique: pause, relax, and open to the experience.
Yeah.
And you'll find that it just goes away a lot quicker that way. And that's just being mindful.
It is.
It's not wanting, because I think a lot of what you began with was how we're a society where our egos always want to grab things and do things and be things. And mindfulness is really just accepting where you are and appreciating it and not wanting to be something bigger or better.
Yeah. That's the essence of it. Simply being at peace with what's occurring, no matter what it is.
And you see so much of a society, if you look at all the advertisements, it's getting loans, winning lawsuits, losing weight without effort. It's all things that, you know, get you something and you don't have to give a lot.
Yeah.
And that's not how it works.
Yeah, it really, that's right. It's about something for nothing. That was, and that's always been, honey, you reminded me of something many, many years ago. Probably most of you wouldn't remember any of this, but there used to be a kind of a scheme of making money by using classified ads, because classified ads were everywhere. Back in magazines, newspapers, etc. That was really one of the ways that people without a lot of money could at least get the word out. But this guy made over $1 million by placing this ad. This is the, I still remember, this is, I must have been 15 when I read this and heard about it. He put an ad in some local magazines and newspapers saying it's your last chance to send in a dollar. And he put an address. He didn't promise anything. But he understood the psychology that there's got to be something in it for me. And he made over $1 million, people sending in their dollar. We're so caught up in it. I tried it. I didn't get anything. It was already... And that's kind of it's the essence of wrong views that tells me I got to get something all the time. And that something can never satisfy, no matter what. I mean, that's kind of like... It's in that way, everybody has a compulsive part of their behavior. And some people, it rises to the level of addiction. But we're all compulsive about protecting that wrong view, aren't we? And we feel that, like we started with this, we feel that life really is a banquet, and the way we win is to take all the food with us.
Yeah.
And try to make sure nobody has as much as we have.
Yeah, and as you said, when you were talking about the Buddha saying life, birth is stressful, getting what you want is stressful, and I thought, wait, we need a rewrite here. I mean, not getting what you want is stressful. I was thinking to myself, we need a rewrite. Also, getting what you want is stressful.
That's right. That's right.
Because that doesn't ever work either.
Yeah.
Not if you're not emotionally equipped to handle it.
You can never satisfy yourself. But that's kind of covered in a backhanded way by getting what is undesired, because that's impermanence. I just got a brand new car. I remember there was a time when I made a lot of money, and for, I think it was 3 years running, I bought a new car every year because I could, not that I needed it. And I still remember the disappointment I had when I drove off the car lot. It was no longer new. And so even, you know, here I am, a young, you know, somewhat successful at that point, driving a brand new car, and there was still an underlying disappointment almost immediately that it's no longer new. Or are you going to say something?
Well, I mean, that's a huge example, but it does... Most minute, it does. We spend the whole life looking at the next moment, the next moment, the next moment.
Mm-hmm.
What Anthony's referring to, and that's all based just on delusion that we are this self that needs to be satisfied. I mean,
and the next moment, something will happen that makes us happy.
Right,
and we're not enough. That we're not
enough. Well, that this is not.
Yeah.
It's not that we're not enough. I mean, yes, that's delusional thinking that there is some weight.
There's something lacking in
there. There is something here.
Yeah.
That's the nature of all the dissatisfaction.
Yeah, it is.
This is this thing. And there's lots of things occurring, as Lorna keeps pointing to. There's this ever-changing flow of whatever, you know, I'm not going to get all into that, but it's that idea that there's this self that can be satisfied is the root of everything, and letting go of that, everything is really fine.
Yeah, and the only satisfaction which that the Buddha teaches is the satisfaction at rest in right view or refined mindfulness. Because that's the only way a mind can be satisfied, when it's seeing things clearly, not conceptually, not instilling or taking your mind into some conceptual place, living in reality, right here, right now, mind united with the body. Judy, good to see you this morning.
Good to be here, John. Thank you. So many things.
Yeah.
And two things is that impermanence is just, to me, it's the umbrella.
It is, right? Yeah.
I mean, it's comforting when something's happening that I don't want to happen, you know. But at also, in my mind, a lot of times when I'm appreciating, and
yeah.
I think, wow, I better appreciate this beautiful day
mm-hmm.
right now, this commute to work, because, wow, you know, it could rain and or it could, you know, change or not be so beautiful. And so that, I love impermanence. I mean, that's
yeah.
like a favorite thing of mine. And another thing that I was thinking of is what you were just, you all were just talking about, it's kind of the concept of one thing I love about vacation is because you're seeing, you're in the moment more, I am anyway, because you're seeing things with new eyes, right?
Yeah.
For the first time.
Yeah.
And so you're focused on them and you go somewhere nice, it's like beauty and it's wonderful. And what I just realized is with mindfulness, you can, I mean, every moment in your everyday life
yeah.
can be that way.
Yeah.
You look at it and even if you're seeing the same people every day, it's a new day, something new could happen, you can interact differently. It's that moment of like the chance of rebirth, right, in the right
yeah.
direction. That is, you don't have to go away for. It should be every day, every minute, every second, right?
Yeah.
So.
And you can enjoy it on the ride to work.
Yes.
That's yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, you don't
yeah.
have to go anywhere.
You don't have to put it in a suitcase.
And,
you don't have to carry it. You don't have to check it on the plane. Right?
But,
well, I mean, truthful there.
I've used the word a lot, essence, but you're describing the essence of the Dhamma. Is simply being at peace. And maybe I can add the word appreciative
mm-hmm.
simply because it's what's occurring.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be a pleasant ride. It could be something that in the past we might have seen as unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's occurring, and we're mindful of it, and it doesn't have to be any different,
mm-hmm.
then it's meaningful.
Yeah.
And so Anthony said something, I can't remember the word that you used. We don't have to, something can occur that might make us feel sad or angry. But because we don't need the experience to be any different than it is, we're still at peace with that. That's why I say often, we learn to be at peace with less than peaceful mind states.
Mm-hmm.
The best example I have, going back to the Buddha got word that his father was dying and he didn't have long to live. The Buddha didn't just, you know, he didn't make like he was not there or was above all that. He got up and walked 140 miles with the hope that he could be with his dad before he passed. But he didn't lose his mind over it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see the difference?
Mm-hmm.
It was an appropriate way to act. It wasn't aloof in any way. It's another thing, a misunderstanding that people get, that when you let go of all your wrong views, you'll be disconnected from the world. You'll be so mindfully connected that every single moment is meaningful. And you don't have to look for that meaning. You don't have to manufacture meaning in your life through concepts or practices. You simply are. Isn't that remarkable?
Mm-hmm.
That's what the Buddha teaches. It's what he realized 2,600 years ago. Great insight, Judy.
Mm-hmm.
You need to come by more often.
I know. I'm usually working.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you made it this morning. Andrew,
yeah.
Good to see you. Always good to see you.
I concur with Laura that today's teaching was really spot on. It's so helpful. Judy and I have both been absent from the Sangha for a while, and it's so helpful to hear it again. And just thinking as you were speaking that you ought to write a chapter in the book about what you're just talking about.
I did.
No. That's why it sounded so good. anyway, it's a pleasure to be back and relearn.
I'm so glad you made it today, Andrew. It's always good to see you. We're so fortunate to have this sangha that's developed here. It really is remarkable. We talk about that a lot. In fact, we went through a couple of classes about the importance of the sangha as part of our dhamma
yeah.
practice. A well-focused sangha, but you know, we We haven't. I'm so glad that you're here as part of it. Maura, good to see you this morning. Do you have anything else?
Oh, I said enough. I would just kind of tag on to, I think when one reads a sutta, hears the Dhamma, know that it's like, I agree with it. It's that it rings, it's concurrent with the truth. So, I've been around even some of the crazy Dhamma places that may have additional embellishments and distractions. But like the heart of the Dhamma is so, like, it feels, like there's a righteousness about it. Like, I don't know, some of those words are loaded, but I think we all know, like, that satisfying, content feeling when hearing something that's right, that's complete, that's whole, that's integrated. It just lands in a place that there's, the resistance that one feels about it, we know, is anatta, trying to struggle for a piece of existence at some point. And, that just gets tiring and boring, and, it dissipates on its own over time. So I think, this, everyone here today has been practicing for some time, so it just feels like the only thing that makes sense, the only place that one would want to invest time in, the only thing one would want to invest time in. And then
you would think,
from that place, you go and you visit your father when your father's dying, because you have mindfulness inner and outer, you know what's appropriate in the situation. Your father would want you to be there. Your mother would want you to be there. You'd want to be there. And it's really being able to have a more 360 view of what's appropriate based on the whole thing. That's all I got.
Thank you. Great class. Well, I can't think of any announcement. There was one. We're going to start a fund. I meant to do it today, get a basket out, but I'll get it next week.
For paying for you?
Yeah, we're going to start a John Haspel fund. What was it? What was George Costanza's fund? The Human Fund. What was it? Money for People. So we're going to start a Human Fund. One of our Sangha members, Mary Beth, runs a Rare and Learning Cooperative, and they could use a sign in the worst way out front to hopefully gather some more people to come there, students. So I'm gonna get a basket out, and we're gonna hopefully raise some money so Mary Beth can buy a nice sign for it.
Yeah.
But I'll get it next week. It's a remarkable school. I've been there twice now. They're reaching kids that were just like me when I was in high school. I wish something like that was there. But they're getting kids that would not normally even have the ability to get focused in normal school, public school, and their kids are learning, and they're excited, and they're happy. And it's just remarkable what she's doing. Anyway, it deserves our support, I think. Our retreat is coming up September 20th to the 23rd. There's still plenty of room if you want to join us. We'll finish with metta, as we always do. So again, find your relaxed meditation posture, and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And take a moment to, again, become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.